Hi, this is Graham Rhodes, and you're listening to the Long River Podcast. I'm delighted to welcome today Ali Gunduz, a resident of Berlin, and I guess as Todd Coombs would say, the axe in evolution, the Swedish gaming company. Ali, welcome to the podcast.
Hi, Graham. Good to be here.
Now, I really have to emphasize that nothing we discuss today is investment advice. We're just two people who follow the company exchanging ideas. You should always do your own research. Right, Ali?
Yeah.
And of course, like, we're going to make mistakes. So if the listeners hear anything that is wrong, or if we miss anything, we'd love to hear from you. So with that, Ali, why don't you begin by telling us a bit about yourself? I'm sure many of us recognize you from Twitter, but who is the man behind the excellent analysis on evolution?
I'm originally from Turkey. I come from a leather making family, like a family of tanners. And we were a supplier to the global fashion industry. And basically 4 years ago, we sold our family business. And I moved to Germany, to Berlin. And yeah, these days I'm a full-time private investor in public stocks and some directly owned real estate as well. And yeah, what I do daily is something that I enjoy tremendously, which is mostly reading, taking notes and thinking. And I hope to do it as my daily occupation for all my life.
One of the things I admire most about you is how deep you go into your research. There are things that come through in your analysis or connections that you make that I don't see anywhere else, like amongst private investors or the sell side. So I wanted to ask you, how many companies do you follow? And do you think focus is one of your strengths?
To be honest, evolution is an exception. I invest currently, I think, around 30 companies, and I follow a few more, obviously. But none of the companies that I follow, I go as deeply as Evolution. It's a great business model on the paper. It just jumps out at you with the margins and the growth and everything. There's no debt. There's no much of a financial engineering. It's a plus that Evolution is a consumer-facing business, so it's a little easier to understand and form your own opinion or get the opinion of others without the use of expert networks and alternative data and so on. But yeah, that's for reasons that I cannot explain in a rational way. Evolution has become my obsession and also my hobby. So where I stand.
So I brought you here today, and sorry to pour cold water over your obsession, but I brought you here today to talk about evolution's issues. And I think there's a few. So we're gonna have a little debate about that, or at least I'm gonna pick your brains. But before we go into the issues, why don't you tell us a little bit about the company and why you think it's great?
Evolution is basically an online casino supplier. And what that means is we have online casinos. With online casinos, you can think about casinosomething.com and casinosomethingelse.com and stuff like that. But when the players log on to those sites, the games are actually not made and run by those operators, by those casino.coms, let's say, traditionally. And they get their games from actual suppliers, from other suppliers. And Evolution's main focus and main success is in the live casino side of the online casino games. And this is where you have a camera and actual human being that acts as the croupier, as the presenter of a game. These can be traditional table games. When you think about the casino, you have baccarat tables and blackjack tables and roulette tables. And you have obviously a person that presents the game to you and that controls the game for you. And you have those people in front of camera, basically, and Evolution sells, so to speak, the servicing of those games to the operators. And in return, they get a commission from the winnings of the casino in a percentage basis. And the good thing about it is Evolution doesn't spend any budget on advertising to the customers, to the consumers. And they are a partner in the operators. The casino's winnings, but they are not a partner in their expenses, basically.
And tell us a bit about live. Like, why is live different from other forms of online gambling? And how is Evolution somehow pulled away from the pack to become the leader in this segment?
What you get with live games are that you see an actual person who is controlling the game and who is drawing the cards, who is throwing the ball, and so on. And what this brings is the consumer's trust that there's someone who is physically handling a deck of cards or a ball or whatever the game involves. And this seems to provide people with the trust that actual game statistics, the game mechanics actually work and that the game is not rigged. Because obviously a crucial, like an inevitable part of gambling or iGaming, as the sector says, is losing money. And at that moment, need to have trust that you lost that money fairly and squarely. Another advantage of live games, I find, is that people are just social animals. We like to see another human person involved in the activity that you're doing, especially if that activity is done for entertainment purposes.
And then I think the other aspect of it is the economics, because it takes quite a lot of money and quite a lot of operational expertise to build a casino and then to staff it with talented dealers who can work well across like many languages and many different games, right? So the fixed costs of this business are very high. Right. And I think that means that if you are in a position with the best games and you can attract the most players, you can take an outsized share of the profit pool.
This is the eternal question, I think, of when you talk about the margins and the growth of this business and you explain the business model, first question always comes up is the moat. Like what stops from anyone from just putting a webcam in front of a roulette wheel and start a competitor? And there are a lot of competitors, but as you said, the fixed costs are a big difficulty in at the current state of the iGaming sector, and scale moat makes a big difference. And so to recuperate the fixed expenses of each table, it requires a very big scale that not all suppliers can achieve. And another critical point here is what you mentioned is the technical expertise of Evolution, where what you see actually in Evolution's games, the studios, the physical studios, are actually each of the studios are regulated casinos. They're actual casinos. They're regulated like actual land-based casinos. And that brings a lot of regulations. Plus, you have a 24/7 running casino where all kind of weird things can happen, all kind of unexpected things can happen. There can be a fire alarm. There can maybe the croupier drops the ball to the floor and stuff like that, where you have to have very consistent and well thought through processes for each of them. Because again, we are not talking about a land-based casino where you interact with the person in person physically, and if someone drops the ball, there's an accident. But online, that trust factor is the crucial part of it. And that's why even small hiccups create a lot of crazy conspiracy theories. You can just go online and Google any of the iGaming suppliers and say just cheating or rigged and stuff, and you will find all kinds of crazy theories about how the games are actually rigged and stuff. Mm-hmm. And another part of that trust equation is actually from the point of view of the casino, where you have to make sure that the games are not cheatable, because you make money very quickly, but that also means you can lose money very quickly if the players find some cheats or some kind of a deterioration in the probability distribution of the game. They can take advantage of it. And by the time you realize that you are being cheated on by the players, you lose a lot of money in the time in between.
I want to ask you, Evolution has dominated this field for so long, but do you think it's becoming more competitive? And do you think that's affecting Evolution's business? So maybe 15 years ago, there was one company which really dominated the space, and that was Playtech. But for a variety of reasons, Playtech fell behind Evolution, the scrappy newcomer, which was focused on one specific vertical, namely live. And Evolution grew the market, and in fact, came to define the market through some of its games like Lightning Roulette and the string of game shows, especially. And for a variety of reasons, Playtech couldn't fight back. But now, like, you have quite a serious competitor, or at least it appears to be, in the form of Pragmatic Games, who's well-funded both from its venture backers and from the apparent success of its slots business. And it feels like they're giving Evolution a real run for their money. At least they're copying Evolution's games very quickly and rolling them out to that global audience very quickly too. What do you think about that?
Good question. Is it competitive? Yes. In the sense of the number of suppliers, the competition is definitely fiercer now. There are a lot more competition. There are a lot more money invested in this, because it's now become obvious that it's a great business model and everyone wants to be in it. But from the point of view of scale, in general, right now the scale is global. So the scale that you have to reach just to reach profitability and hopefully expand from there is very high. So I'm actually not sure if I would say that competition right now is a lot fiercer. Though a lot more people are involved, a lot more companies are involved. Pragmatic seems to be on everyone's minds these days, but I will also have to be honest about my limitations on how much I understand on pragmatic. Because first of all, yeah, it's a private company that seems to mostly be active in unregulated markets, though not exclusively. So this means that there is no actually healthy data that we can compare the companies with. But one lesson that I take from pragmatic, which I think is also applies to evolution as well, is when we look at pragmatic's history, as far as I know, is that they are, first of all, originally an RNG company, a slots company, not a live company. And they also don't seem to make a lot of big acquisitions like evolution recently did. So what we have is that we have a company that has organically grown its expertise and slots game portfolio through the years. And what the lesson that I take from this is that when it comes to game development, but also to game distribution, the culture of the company, that ephemeral thing, is crucial. Although you cannot put it on paper in a clear way, that seems to be crucial. And yes, now they're coming for the live too. I have no idea how successful they are, but they seem to have found some success at least. And first of all, how I apply this lesson to evolution is evolution has that ephemeral, that culture in live casino development and distribution. They have that expertise, and I do not see them easily lose that edge over other players. But again, this is my observation. I don't have concrete data for it. That's just my observation. And this also means that I do not see much of a future for evolution RNG as well.
One of the things that really defines evolution, like I said earlier, is the creation of the game show genre. And for the folks listening, if you don't know what that is, they took casino games like roulette, they mixed them up with some elements of slots, and they created these like all singing, all dancing spectacles, really. If you watch some of the videos of Crazy Time, they're just incredible, really mesmerizing, and above all, quite fun. And as evolution created this category, they brought in a lot of new players to the market who previously were interested in RNG, but now are interested in live. And Ali, the question I have for you is, it feels like the game show category is now getting mature, and it feels like it's easier for people to follow, or more bluntly, to copy. And I think I heard from some sources that the amount that evolution spent on Funky Time might have run into like the high eight or even low nine digits. And I just wonder, are they going to get the same return on that investment as they were before? Is it enough of a moat now to be creative in a mature category?
So I'm wondering if you are a little too quick to call game shows as a mature category. Yes, there is no Crazy Time like big leap into the future that's coming from evolution in the form of a new game. And I'm not expecting them to come up with a new category defining game anytime soon. But I like to remember the big picture. Game shows at a category has a huge growth potential. I think it's far from being a mature category. And I'm not talking about market share, but the market's share of the overall entertainment industry in the world. It will be a crude analogy, but Apple doesn't have to come up with an iPhone-like new category of device every year or every 5 years. And the opportunity here is still so big, and evolution is still at the head of it, that I think evolution is in a great place when we keep the big picture in mind.
And yeah, but I'm just going to push back on that a little bit, because
sure.
I think one of the things that excites me about evolution is that its success begets more success. Because it's doing well and it has the scale, it has the budget to invest more in R&D and new games than anyone else. And you can see that, right? Like they launched, you correct me, like a lot of new live games this year, as well as their RNG games. But if the category matures and the return on that investment, either in terms of WoW share or actual dollar share, then it feels like that aspect of their moat is shrinking or would shrink. And then as well, like if you dive into the brass tacks of this, I think they've been getting a really good share of GGR from their clients, because their clients must have Crazy Time, And if the category becomes mature and Crazy Time just becomes one of many games, then doesn't that weaken Evolution's bargaining power too?
So the scenario that you're drawing, and correct me if I'm wrong, that live casino could become like the RNG markets where you have many games and the games themselves individually are commoditized, and then Evolution is just one of the game show providers, basically.
Yeah, at the most extreme end of the spectrum, yeah.
There is some truth to that. I think there is some risk to that. So live casino games up to this point have been so unique that they have been so decommoditized, so to speak. The trend could go in that direction, but I do not see game shows becoming too commoditized. It can go in that direction to a certain degree, but I do not believe it will change radically from here. And there's a simple reason for that. Running a game show is expensive as hell, and it's a money-losing proposition. It's nothing like RNG. In RNG, you develop a game, however big of a budget it takes, you develop a game, and usually it's a small budget, and then it costs almost $0 to run it today, and then $0 tomorrow, and $0 the day afterward. But with the game shows, I would think, you know, if a game is successful, or if a game runs for a considerable amount of time, for multiple years, the running cost of the game should be a lot higher than the development cost of it. And that's why you cannot have like the overabundance of games like what happened in RNG. But again, I'm talking in matters of degree. I'm trying to keep the big picture in mind. I'm not saying that it's not going to get commoditized, but I'm saying two things. One is that especially for the suppliers that are not the biggest three suppliers, let's say the suppliers who are not Evolution, Pragmatic, and Playtech, let's take all other suppliers together. It's very difficult to try out a new game show. And you do not know if it didn't take off yet, and it will take off next month. But do you really want to keep investing in that studio and that presenter that keeps losing money? The second thing is, Evolution still seems to be the leader in terms of game development, in terms of IP, in terms of new ideas, in terms of innovation. So I expect some surprise in the upside to come, and I expect that surprise in the upside to come from Evolution rather than others. It doesn't have to happen that way. So that's a prediction or estimation for the future. But I think in the big picture, in the aggregate, Evolution will come up with better new games than the competitors, because competitors will always have, these includes Pragmatic and Playtech as well, they will always need to catch up with Evolution, and their budgets are smaller than Evolution. So their main concern is to, first of all, catch up to Evolution, and whatever is the surplus on that budget, on that game development budget, yes, they would spend it on creating innovative new types of games. But that will always come second as long as they try to catch Evolution. And the second part is your question about budgets on per game basis and the returns on it. I would expect them to be lower. Obviously, $1 spent on the development of Crazy Time, the returns that you get on that $1 is almost impossible to replicate. But even though a new game may get a lot smaller market share, the in nominal terms, the amount of profits and free cash flow it creates can still be quite considerable. And Evolution's game development, I still think that the quality of games that create still seems to be the best in class. And they have, on top of that, they have their scale advantage for every game that they create, because every game that they create starts with a lot bigger consumer pool.
Okay, so you were saying before that one of the things that most interests you about the company is the potential in the future. So I have to ask you about Asia. It seems, and you made a bit of fun of this too online, a lot of the growth in recent quarters has been coming from Asia. And it just feels like that is a black box, and a black box where something quite bad could happen, as I think happened to Playtech as well. Ali, I appreciate you might be shooting in the dark here, but why don't you tell us a bit about Asia and your thoughts on that?
Asia is both the big opportunity and the big risk. Because first of all, the majority of growth in the recent years has been coming from Asia. And we can guess that Asian consumers or the Asian market is a lot more profitable than the rest of the world because it's simply a lot better scaled. You have few studios in Eastern Europe and you have unregulated sales sources in Asia to all countries from a handful of studios. But it's also a big risk because, first of all, Evolution is very consistent in not disclosing which markets that is, because Asia is a very big place. And compared to Europe, used to be their traditional big market, but Europe is not disclosed, at least until recently, as Europe. They would disclose which parts of Europe we're talking about. Is it UK, the continental Nordics. Europe or Nordics? And even during the earnings call, they would also give some per country metrics when needed, where they would say, oh, in the UK market, this happened, and because of that, this happened, and so on. Where in Asia, we do not have any kind of disclosure. But let's try to understand it. I think the most important single question on the Asia is how big is mainland China in it, or is it inside in a significant way? That would be an almost thesis breaker, because that's a country that's hard to get the cash out of. That's the risks. The Communist Party, stop any kind of revenues unpredictably, and so that would be a big negative. And my question, at least my current understanding of it, is Mainland China is not a big market for Evolution. First of all, technically, it would be very hard. Piercing the Great Firewall is difficult, especially if you need to do real-time streaming. So you do not have, you cannot afford any kind of latency, but you couldn't stream directly into China from outside because that would be very easy for the Great Firewall to block. But then you can have CDNs or some kind of proxy service in China, maybe illegally, but even then you would have the problem of having the latency of from the main server. Your video stream would need to go to that proxy and then to the end user. That would be very difficult. And it's also part of the technical moat of Evolution as well, where having real-time and unbuggy video stream is critical, because if you're a gamer and you're playing a game from a video stream and you lose some money and it happens to have some kind of glitch during that second, it's easy to complain about it and be suspicious about it. And second reason why I don't think China is a big Evolution's market, is a big market for Evolution, is getting cash out of country would be very difficult. There is a huge, even bigger than Pragmatic, I would think, maybe even still bigger than Evolution, company that seems to be specialized in it, though I'm not sure. That's called Asia Gaming, or companies who are experts in it. They may be finding some ways for the two difficult that I name here, but I do not think China is a big market for Evolution. But that's just the first question. That's the biggest risk. Just because that's not an issue doesn't mean Asia itself is not an issue. But I think in the aggregate, Asia and unregulated markets in general present an opportunity rather than not, as long as Evolution keeps being the cleanest supplier available everywhere. As long as Evolution doesn't lose that reputation, and as long as Evolution gives us reasonable effort to there and proves that to regulators, and I see that, I don't see any evidence to the contrary, I think that Asia risk is more of an opportunity than a risk. And I like that.
Yeah, you make lots of good points there. And I think you have to make a distinction, as you did, between mainland China, where I believe online gambling is illegal, and every other country in Asia, where they're, I believe, again, just looking at the kind of languages they're adding to tables, India, South Korea, and elsewhere, they're growing very fast too. But again, it just feels like we're shooting in the dark.
Yes, I am not happy with management's current level of disclosure. Maybe we'll touch on it on different parts of the questions as well. But on the regulatory side, on the regulatory risks and regulatory characteristics of Evolution's global sales, I also understand management's reluctance not to disclose too much on it. Because whether we like it or not, in means of which market rules apply to where and how they apply it, especially in unregulated markets, disclosure creates its own risks, unfortunately. That's a political fact. If Evolution is very popular in country X, where they do not have clear rules on it, so it's not considered regulated, it's not actively banned, but it's also not actively allowed, and it's a little muddy, and Evolution gives too much details on how much of sales they have there and through how they get their payments and how their customers, the operators, market there, that can create its own risks. So to be honest, I'm not really sure, and I understand management reluctance disclosing the details of unregulated markets. Doesn't necessarily mean I agree with everything that they do or everything that they choose to disclose or not, but I think I understand the reasoning in terms of unregulated market disclosures.
So you also mentioned the opportunity in the United States, and I have a couple of questions for you there too, but let's start with probably the easy one. How come they haven't launched Crazy Time in the States?
Very good question. That's what I'm waiting for as well. I'm very excited on how the US consumer will react to the whole genre. But let's get into the detail of the US regulations. Online gambling, online gaming was regulated in some states of the US. But when you look at the regulators, they are not newly created online regulators. We're talking about those states already established gambling regulators. And where their expertise lies is obviously regulating land-based casinos. So that's why they have an expertise in regulating table games and slot games. And that's also how, from my guess, how both regulatory rules and how those applied, the processes were designed up to this point. So evolution is completely in the right in trying to introduce game shows to the US, but it's also a first of its category for the regulators as well. That seems to be the barrier to entry. So that takes some time for them to clear everything up. In the end, that can turn into a moat as well, because that they would be the only company in the world who know how regulators regulate game shows. And all games need to be adjusted slightly for every state's regulations and processes and their criteria. So that creates some expertise in itself. And yes, the management seems to be confident, from my guess, in introducing the game in some states, at least in next year, so in 2024. And for me, from my point of view, in the long term, it doesn't matter if they release it in December this year or in November next year. But the more important question will be, I think, when we're looking at it from 5 years or 10 years from now on, is will it take off in the US? Well, because it doesn't have to have, not every consumer's. In the US and consumers elsewhere do not have the same tastes. They can have different reactions, but that's one of the hidden upsides, so to speak, to maybe not so hidden. It's constantly talked about, but it's not something priced in, I would say, or it's one of the that can come up, but that is just one of many. So even if it doesn't take off in the US, the whole game show category, evolution still has many other opportunities elsewhere.
Okay. Now, just on the U.S., one of the interesting things that's happened over the last 18 months as we get into sort of the second or the third innings, however you want to define it, of sports betting and online gambling, is that it feels like market shares are beginning to settle now, and two clear winners have emerged, namely FanDuel and DraftKings. And one has to wonder, like looking at the field, whether people want to keep burning money trying to compete. And I can understand, like, the desire, given the size of the market and everything. But yeah, that's a question. And so with evolution, I wanted to ask you, what does it look like for evolution then when it only has two potential customers at an extreme case in the United States? Does that affect its bargaining power again?
I think yes and no. So I will divide the question into two parts, RNG and live. And in RNG, which seems to be a considerable market for evolution, according to what they said last quarter's earnings call. In RNG, evolution is at operators' mercy, I think. It doesn't matter if there are only two operators or five operators. I think evolution is still at the operators' mercy because there are too many games and new RNG suppliers keep getting approved into the US. And there are also I will come to that, traditional slot developers that are also taking some action. And there are just too many games available. They are very cheap to run, as we discussed before. It costs almost nothing to run a RNG game for a day or for a week or for a year after you get it developed and approved. And so it's up to the operators to promote and give best shelf space, so to speak, to the games that they like. And furthermore, Evolution doesn't even have the premium IP that US players are familiar with. what are US players familiar with? They're familiar with the slot franchises that are that have been developed by Aristocrat and Scientific Gaming. Yeah, they're called Light and Wonder now, I think, from regular land-based cabinets, slot cabinets. And there's now some new game launches where those suppliers are converting those franchises into online games, and they have an obvious advantage. And it's also create some synergy for the casinos as well. And so in RNG, yes, Evolution is not in a very, it's not at the perfect position, let's say. It's just one of the suppliers without the critical IP. But Live is a whole different ballgame. And first of all, Evolution has the best product at the moment. But there is, in parallel to that, US comes with its own scale dynamics. So we have state-by-state openings and state-by-state studios by mandate. So what that means is each studio and each table run in the US has a lower profitability. That's true for Evolution compared to Evolution's US tables to European tables, but that's also true for everybody. It's also, each of these tables also address a smaller market, a much, much smaller market, just one state. Yep. So it's a lot harder to reach scale. That threshold of scale is a lot harder to reach, even in its current early non-mature form. So that means that, yes, there will be competition, and it will take some time for it to find its balance. And it will take at least some years for the hopeful competitors to come in and burn some money and so on. But in the end, it has to thin out the competition, as long as we do not get into a federal legalization where at least you can have one studio in the US and serve all states, which I don't think is happening anytime soon.
It sounds like for you, it's just a question of when. Like, when is crazy time going to come to the market? Escape commoditization.
From my point of view, the two big questions in the US market is, first of all, yes, will game shows take off? I'm really interested in knowing that and getting to an answer to that. And second, is US market an interesting market? On which I have not concluded yet. I do not know, because I don't think it's flattered.
What do you mean by interesting market?
It may turn out to be a very small profit pool.
Yes.
So it may turn out that some single Asian country may turn out to have a bigger profit pool than US because of the regulations, because how it's marketed state by state. And so I'm not saying it is, but I think it has not been decided yet, or it has not been clear yet, at least from my point of view. Those two things are bigger questions for me than, are the US operators too powerful?
I want to take a step back again to focus on growth. So one of the interesting comments that Martin Carlson made in the third quarter earnings call was that growth this year was held back by a lack of capacity. They didn't have enough tables. They hadn't built enough casinos. So I want to ask you, do you believe that? And if so, how did they end up in that situation with insufficient capacity?
Yeah. The lack of studio expansion has been my main disappointment in 2023. There is no clear disclosure on what it is. I have one theory. I'm not sure if it's true, but I can share it. One theory is the unmet demand that they're talking about was maybe for local language tables, Dutch tables or Indian tables or Korean tables and so on, where the presenter speaks in the language of that end market. And maybe they have been finding it a little difficult to hire the necessary personnel since their studios are in Georgia and in Armenia and in Latvia and Malta, not where you have typically find Korean speakers, for example. Mm-hmm. So that is one theory, but this brings my main pet peeve with the management. We talked before about the regulatory questions and why management is not disclosing much about it. For that, at least I have an excuse, not an agreement, but in general, business performance, when there is a success, management talks is very passionate and explains how they manage that success and what's the scale of the success in detail, or at least in considerable detail. But when some business failure happens, this can be a lack of studio expansion. This can be RNG not growing and actually losing market share. When that happens, and that will inevitably happen, I'm not talking about why those failures happen, but when they inevitably happens, the management doesn't share clear reasons for why they happened and how they proposed to come up with solutions to that. So that lack of communication is, that's one failure of management that I find, not one time, but it's a general theme with them. And that's, yeah, that's my main pet peeve with the management, even though it may not answer your question completely, because the answer to your question is, I do not know. I do not know why they're not expanding when there's unmet demand. That sounds...
No, but I agree with you. I agree with you. And you are not the first person to tell me like how terse management can be on the earnings calls. Oftentimes you don't learn anything. I get what you're saying. Let's talk about studio expansion as one element of capital allocation. And I think this has been another like hot debate out there, because you've worked out the numbers, right? It's, I don't know, something like close to €1 billion was spent on R&G. And What is your assessment of that project? Like, first of all, was it necessary? And second of all, yeah, is it working? And when is it going to work?
It hasn't worked yet. So that much is clear. I'm not saying anything new there. But was it necessary? I can try to find some reasons for it to so that it's a balanced discussion, let's say, where, you know, when NetEnt was acquired for that €2.2 billion with issuing new shares, they were already in Live Casino, and they actually, I think they announced that they were going to expand in the US too. Evolution acquired them and just shut down the whole Live Casino department that was already loss making. But we would need a parallel universe to see what would happen if Evolution didn't acquire them. So there may be some strategic reason in that I could excuse. Yeah. And they acquired some IP that they used for combined slot and live games and stuff like that. But obviously this hasn't worked out. They made some big acquisitions, and in the end, up to this now, the growth has been terrible. But, and that's we're making with the benefit of the hindsight. But there are some things that are noble. I think that they were noble, and they were a little overambitious, I think. For example, with NetEnt, at the time of the acquisition, NetEnt was shrinking. When you look at their latest financials, the year before Evolution acquired NetEnt, NetEnt acquired another RNG studio called Red Tiger. And if you take the Red Tiger's numbers out, NetEnt, even though it was trying to expand in Live Casino at the same time, it was shrinking. I would guess, even though it was a private company, so I don't have concrete data, but I would think that No Limit was also at its peak, or maybe has already began shrinking, because right after the acquisition, it started shrinking. So I think there were some noble mistakes or noble risks that could have been known by the management at the time of the acquisition.
You were really like stressing before the importance of culture, and you were contrasting Evolution with Pragmatic's success at developing like this RNG development culture in-house, like organically. Whereas it just feels like the last few years, Evolution has been the exit of choice for RNG companies, which are getting a little bit past their prime.
I can definitely understand the sellers here, because there was a big rush into iGaming in all its forms. And these companies, maybe at least some of them, seem to have peaked, at least locally peaked in the terms of a few years. And here this company is coming with at least a great cash price, or in terms of shares of the highest quality iGaming company in the world. Either way, it was a good bet from their point of view, I think. Was Evolution right to buy? I don't think so. Even with the data that they already had, I find it hard to believe that, especially the acquisitions that came after NetEnt. With NetEnt, that had a live section to it as well, and it was a little unknowable, and it was the crazy year of 2020, so it was COVID, and everyone was going to play online and stuff like that. I can excuse that, but by the time they acquired No Limit City last year, they already knew that RNG was failing in its current form, in that present form. And No Limit was just a bolt-on acquisition. With NetEnt, maybe there was some synergy, or at least they would take out a live competitor. With Big Time Gaming, that's a franchise that encompasses other franchises. So it's actually a really interesting business model for an RNG. There, I can find some excuses. DigiWheel is like a cute small acquisition. I think that was a good thing that they did. Too small to mention. But by the time of their latest acquisition of No Limit, it was just a developer that develops a distinctive certain types of games that doesn't have any kind of synergy or intersection with live games. I don't think we will ever see a no limit city like live games in Evolution, because the games will be just too controversial. Exactly. I cannot imagine a real person thing doing like a mafia or drugs or that kind of a theme live game and have it accepted by regulators. That would be just a PR disaster.
Judging by the latest calls again, it feels like they've decided to stop putting more capital into RNG acquisitions, at least. What do you think they need to do? And again, I'm asking you to shoot in the dark and hypothesize, but what do you think they need to do to get RNG right and to get to, what are they aiming for, like double-digit organic growth?
I do not know. I do not know if it's possible, because there's that classic Buffett quote where when a good management meets a disastrous business, it's usually the business that holds its reputation. Evolution is a great company, but it has a great management, has big key personnel, but it also had the correct product and correct business model. If you just take the same people and have them develop, I don't know, video games like Ubisoft or something like that, It's not a given that they would succeed. I'm not predicting that RNG will fail horribly and stuff, but I cannot imagine at least pure RNG, pure sloth games being a big part of their success for the years ahead. I just do not see it reasonable, realistic, or even necessary for the shareholders.
So you don't think Evolution is at a strategic disadvantage if it doesn't have good slots in its portfolio?
I do not think it does. I cannot say I have completely thought through every implication of this, but live is something completely different. Obviously, it's good to be able to provide the full package to operators, which the management always stresses. But I do not see Evolution also providing RNG slots make a big difference in the operator's decision-making process. Even if Evolution acquires all the for sale RNG studios, they will still have only a tiny portion of the total RNG market. There are thousands upon thousands of RNG games and tens of thousands. And yeah. So if Evolution acquires a few more hundreds of games or releases a few hundreds more games, they will not have that market lockdown, so to speak. So they will always be one of the RNG suppliers.
Push on that. It seems like Pragmatic's actually doing pretty well, and they've managed to carve out quite a strong base in RNG, where putting out a good cadence of games, the games have good traction, and it feels like they're very profitable. And as a result of that, like, operators want to have them, which I guess opens the window to cross-selling a live product. So again, you know, from what little we know, what is Pragmatic doing right, in your opinion?
I see two reasons for that. Again, we do not have any kind of clear data on what Pragmatic is doing, what kind of results they are getting. But yes, this is also the feedback that I usually find from industry insiders and consumers, that Pragmatic is quite good and sloth games quite successful there. First of my reasons that I can think of is that ephemeral, that culture. They have grown up as an RNG suppliers. They know what they're doing, and they have organically tried and tested and failed and succeeded. So they have that expertise, that in-house expertise, not only in the means of experienced developers, but the management knows which threads to pursue, which opportunities to pursue, and which opportunities to let go, and so on. With Evolution, we do not have such a thing. We do not, the management, the upper management doesn't have a history of developing and marketing successful RNG games. And moreover, which is another smaller pet peeve with management that I have, is at least there's no disclosure on it, but they do not seem to have consolidated the game development for RNG games. No Limits game development is done almost independently from Evolution. I think there was an interview where the head of No Limit City said that he would welcome if Todd Householder had an idea that they would, for them to implement. It was like, that was if he had a suggestion. And I would also understand that, for example, that specific studio's style is so different from other stuff that I don't know how successful you can combine them. But then you do not have a studio. You have one company, but you do not have an Evolutions RNG. You have NetEnt. You have Red Tiger. You have Big Time. Yeah. You have No Limit and so on. We're not talking about one studio. We are talking about five studios.
Yeah. Wasn't that supposed to be a strength, though? These guys would come on board and each studio would retain its unique culture, the culture that had helped them succeed in the first place.
Then why did those studios need evolution if evolution has nothing to add here? Because yes, one-stop shop is a nice thing, but that was never the problem, I think, that the big operators already had No Limit and Big Time Gaming and NetEnt and Red Tiger already in their systems. That was not the barrier. That was not a big barrier for the big players. If evolution is not adding something here, then what is evolution doing? Then it's just random five RNG studios, and we're betting that Carlos betted on the right horses and not on the wrong horses. And we do not, and he doesn't have any impact on the quality of the outcome.
Yeah.
And so I think that view is a little incomplete, a little, it needs a little more baking. I'm not talking about as your thesis, but as management apparent thesis for getting those companies, and we're going to keep pushing games, and we're going to integrate it to one-stop shop. And because it's in one-stop shop, it will be a sudden success. It has happened. I understand why they think that, because this has worked with Live Studio. With Live Casino, when Evolution comes up with a new Live Casino game, it reaches a lot more players than other studios. So it has a big advantage there. But with RNG, it's not like that. With RNG, you're just adding one more game into the pool of 10,000 games.
Yeah, I completely agree. And actually, the irony, you touched on this, but quickly moved on. Maybe the best acquisition was DigiWheel, because if I understand correctly, it's the DigiWheel which led to the idea for Crazy Time.
Right. Also, it provides one way that Pragmatic, for example, cannot copy, as far as I understand, Funky Time or some other upcoming Evolution games. Because when you look at, Pragmatic had just a new game release recently. I was looking at its reviews, that there was a video feed on it, and they had a big wheel in the middle, as most game shows do. And the wheel seemed to be like a cardboard thing, like an analog traditional game wheel. Okay. And maybe the reason for that is they cannot put a digital wheel there because it's patented by Evolution through DigiWheel. So that adds a moat to the to Evolution games. It makes it just a little bit harder for competitors to copy them.
So continuing with the theme of capital allocation, we've talked about the adventure or the misadventure in RNG. The other controversy has been buybacks, but I guess that's been settled now. What do you think of the recently announced €400 million buyback?
Can I actually take a big picture view on the whole capital allocation thing? Because I think it will be a recurring theme that the Evolution has. So to summarize it is that Evolution has already surpassed the necessary minimum scale threshold. So right now they're making money fist over, like, how do you say it?
Hand over fist.
So now they're making money hand over fist. They have too much cash flow. And ideally what they would want is, when you have such a profitable and growing business, you want to reinvest those cash flows into new investments, into new expansions, and earn a return on the return cash, so to speak. So to compound cash flow. But the problem is Evolution can't. Evolution cannot do it this year. Evolution cannot do it next year. Evolution will probably, unless a big trouble happens, or unless Mars legalizes online gambling, they will keep having the same issue. They have a great amount of, they have a gust of cash flow, but curse of the business model is they cannot invest this organically. It's just like a very small percentage of it is already enough for the expansion of studios and game development and so on. So there is this surplus cash flow, and what to do will always be a topic. What can you do with this surplus cash flow? There's no debt, so we cannot, can take that off the options. So you have two main options. You either return this cash flow to the shareholders, or you make external investments. On the shareholder side, they already have half of it as dividends, and then the rest, then the question comes, what do you do with the rest of it? Even if the dividend policy doesn't change. And that's I think, another question that a lot of shareholders are questioning. But let's assume that they keep that policy. Then all you can do is external investments, and hope that you make good returns on those investments. And here I understand management's, or at least I can predict management's concerns, because when you look at Evolution's growth, first of all, the growth only comes from the Live Casino. And when you look at how much of new revenue is added to the revenue pool, so to speak, every quarter or every year, it's actually quite consistent. It's the machine is working in an almost consistent way. It's generating the machine the live casino machine is creating a almost consistent growth periodically. But then because the general sales pool is getting larger and larger, the growth rates are crashing and they will keep crashing as a matter of mathematics, because the nominal amount you add to the sales is the same. So from their point of view, and from the point of a CEO and the management, upper management and the board, I would guess that they want to show higher percentages, higher growth percentages. So the only way you can do is you make some external investments. If you cannot do any more internal investments, you make some external investments and pray to God that they create also some kind of a growth, which hasn't happened yet. But that means that will be a question next year and the year after that and the year after that as well. So here comes with this business model, you have then the question that will come up again and again.
In a sense, it feels like management have come to the same conclusion as you. And the investments into RNG were one way to answer the question. Can we take what we know in live and use the cash that we've earned to invest elsewhere? It feels like the answer to that so far is no.
I think they were thinking they were making an internal investment. It was like RNG is just like live. It was just expanding our current business. But it turns out, or I would argue, that it's not the same business at all. It's like buying sportsbook. It's gambling. It's a whole different thing. And even though maybe they're the same operators offer sportsbooks as well. So it's, and let me just make the case for the other scenario, that the scenario that I advocate for, which is that keep the kingdom small and you would still have great results, even though the kingdom doesn't grow as quickly. Because you have, first of all, you can distribute dividends. Then comes obviously the buyback. And I would argue that Evolution, even if they keep the same 50% dividend payout policy, Evolution would make the ideal share cannibal. Because first of all, it makes a lot of cash that it doesn't have a use for even after dividends. And second of all, though this is a not universal thing, maybe 2 years ago, I would not be able to say it, but it's a sin sector stock. So I'm saying it's like a funny thing to say to the shareholder, but hopefully it will keep that discount. You know, Evolution, the management, the boards or the shareholders' cash will buy more shares of it. So in the long run, it could turn into a great share cannibal and that would create great returns for the shareholders. But on the other hand, yes, the kingdom stays small. So the kings, the CEOs, the managements, the boards, kingdom stays small. So there is that counterbalance to that. You know, it's a matter of incentives.
Yeah, we'll get to that in a second. I think what struck me about the buyback announcement last month was it just felt like, first of all, it was made reluctantly under duress, supposedly from pressure from a lot of American investors. And the issue I have is it just felt very ad hoc. So it doesn't feel like smart capital allocation. It just feels like something they might do once, as opposed to thinking more systematically along the lines that you advocated.
Right. I agree with you. I have the same feelings. I'm happy that they decided on it, but I'm also still a little bewildered that they do not want to commit to a disclosed capital allocation policy, because many companies do that. It's not that sophisticated. You say, I have the amount of cash, obviously I will make my expansions. From the rest, I will have this kind of a dividend policy, whatever it is. With the rest, with surplus cash, depending on the valuation of the stock, maybe you say, if it makes sense on a free cash flow per share basis, I commit to making that at least a part of my decision process. As you said, it's very ad hoc. This year they decided, but they don't want to commit to it for next year. Let's say the valuation remains low. And as I said, this is not a one-off question. This question, in fact, will get the more successful Evolution becomes, this question will get bigger and bigger. The cash surplus will get bigger and bigger. As a function,
I don't want to be in a position in the fall of 2024 where we're having the same conversation about what are they doing with all that cash.
If everything goes right, we will be having the same discussion in 2030 as well.
And the interesting thing, right? Companies normally have this embarrassment of riches once they reach a certain stage of maturity, when growth starts to slow and you don't have the same need for capital investment. But as you alluded to earlier, Evolution's always been like this. I don't think they needed to go public to raise money. I think it was just an exit for existing shareholders. And correct me if I'm wrong, Ali, but they've basically had a net cash balance sheet ever since then.
As far as I know.
I think something more systematic would be good.
Right. Maybe the reason for it is, I'll make a quick parenthesis here, but maybe it's because they have reached this embarrassment of riches while they're still a growth company. Because it was, if they were a mature company, they could have a more, you know, mature capital allocation policy where they balance between investments and dividends and buybacks and stuff. But they're a growth company. So management feels maybe that they are expected to deliver growth percentages. Yeah. And when that growth percentage keeps getting smaller, the figure itself keeps getting so smaller, they're pressured to boost up somehow.
Pretty good way to grow EPS is to reduce the share count.
True, but I think the market still speaks about not EPS growth, but on the general revenue growth.
True. All right. That brings us to probably the most controversial question of this podcast, which is exactly about incentives. What do you think about the executive compensation plan, which was issued and then suddenly withdrawn only to come back again with a strike price, some, I forget now, 30% lower than the original one?
Let's make a quick recap of what happened this year.
Yes, please.
There was an original proposal for the incentives. They, maybe not every year, but most years, they come up with a new incentive scheme with a 3-year horizon. And this year, they came up with one again. And as far as I know, for the first time, it was rejected by shareholders. And then they came up with a second proposal, which actually cut the number of warrants in half. And that happened maybe when the price was a little higher than today. And then after the calculation period for it has passed, the price, stock price kept, you know, falling and falling. And then they came up basically with a price adjustment. They said, we're going to repeat the whole process again. We'll calculate the base price from it again. And that's how we came today. How I look at it, to be honest, from my point of view, the issue itself is not that big of a deal for two reasons. First of all, I think at least for the growth up to this now, the dilution that we're talking about is relatively small. And even the more important reason from my point of view is, as we talked about before, evolution success is not a simple conclusion of its first mover advantage. It was not the first, as we talked about. It was all about their execution, how well they executed their game development and game distribution and so on. And that execution is dependent on evolution's key personnel. So again, we come to the key man risks here as well, and at least partially. So I think it's important to keep the key personnel at least reasonably happy, satisfied, and well aligned with the company's operational success, because probably almost all of them are getting proposals for new job offers from competing companies and startups every month or at least every year. At least I'm okay with keeping them happy, but I'm not happy the way that the board, especially the board, fumbled it this year. If we just had this current incentive program and it was the original incentive program and it was accepted and so on, then I don't think we would be discussing it right now, since that small, relatively small percentage of dilution that we're talking about. But the way that they fumbled it, it was, the whole thing was an ugly process. And what I fear about is that if this will happen again, I don't know if they will come up with a new incentive program for 2024, since this year's incentive was done so late in the year. But let's say it happens, they come up with a new one in 2025, let's say, or it can happen next year as well as too. But I think the board should improve themselves in better communicating with shareholders in advance, because when you do this, when you have this fumbling, it's not about looking bad, but it's about, from the insider's perspective, I imagine, it creates two things. First of all, it creates internal strife. You put parts of the company, because shareholders are a part of the company as well, so you put parts of the company in conflict with each other, in negotiation against each other, where, you know, their interests are not aligned during that thing. And another factor that you create is what we saw with the last proposal, is that it's apparent that the company insiders keep track of the stock price, which is a horrible thing, which they concentrate too much on it. And this creates a further incentive to, if the discussion takes too long and this whole thing of negotiations and renegotiations take place, then they start thinking about base price and what's the base price today and so on. What if we repeat the whole process? And again, you create a culture, or you deteriorate the culture to a point where company insiders keep thinking about what stock price is doing today, which is, in the long term, I don't think it's a good thing.
Yeah, I completely agree. And it just, as you say, like, that strife creates suspicions, and the suspicion means we can't give management the trust that they need to reinvest that capital for us.
Yeah.
Yeah, I take your point that maybe this year was somewhat of a fumble. And yeah, I do hope they do better next year.
I think the responsibility lies with the board on this issue.
Yeah, I totally agree. I totally agree.
On the topic of the board, I'll just add something quickly where I had a similar, I think, vision with you. I was very happy that new Americans were joining the board, where almost half the board votes are now are responsive of Americans, because I think compared to the European culture, I think American corporate culture is a lot more rational in capital allocations and in some other parts as well. And so this was the capital allocation up to this now has been a letdown for me. Like it has been not as clear as I hoped when the board composition, but also the shareholder composition and the big shareholders that you see there with the big American groups like WC and Capital Group and stuff like that. I hoped that this would bring a more rational capital allocation. Hopefully it will come, but maybe take a few years. But yeah, I'm still keeping my hope, but it hasn't turned out as I expected to be.
Okay. Let's wrap it up here then, Ali. I think what would be really cool is if you just remind us again, like you post regularly, you write these excellent updates after every quarter's results. Why do you do that? Like you're a private investor. Why do you share this publicly? What's in it for you?
Two reasons. One is self-discipline. When I create such a routine for me, I create an expectation on myself to do the same thing again. And so I keep a good track of the company. So there's that part. And the second and even more important part is I want to be wrong. I want to be corrected and I want to be wrong publicly so that people would correct me and get me better ideas. Another obviously side effect of it is I get to meet successful investors like yourself and also the industry insiders who come up with different insights that are new for me. So it has been a pretty good experience.
And on that note, if people want to reach out to you, get in touch, what's the best way for them to do that?
I guess it would be on Twitter. My handle is @GNUFS, so GNUFS. And I also have a Substack on don'tdistribute.com. It was a piece of reverse psychology.
Both of those links in the show notes. Ali, it's been wonderful to speak with you. I've learned a lot from you. And thank you again for agreeing to do this podcast.
Oh, thank you. It was great. Thank you.